Brenner versus Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So maybe it's makeup of the Panthers. Okay, Mr. Ackley.
Good morning. Please report. My name is Robert Ackley, and I represent the petitioners Jamie Reisner Brenner and Stephen C. Brenner, and they petition for review of the October 2, 2002 opinion and order of the Commodity Futures Commission, Trading Commission, finding that Mr. Brenner had violated Section 8B of the Commodity Exchange Act, and that his wife, Jamie Reisner Brenner, had violated Section 13A by aiding and abetting those violations. As part of its order, the CFTC imposed a cease and desist order, a permanent trading ban, and a civil monetary penalty of $300,000 against Mr. Brenner, and a cease and desist order together with a civil monetary penalty of $100,000 upon Mrs. Brenner. Your Honor, I previously reserved 2 minutes of time for rebuttal. There are three issues for your review and consideration. The first is whether the Commodity Futures Trading Commission dared as a matter of law when it concluded that Stephen Brenner violated Section 8B of the Commodity Exchange Act, where there was no evidentiary basis for drawing such a conclusion. And similarly, whether Jamie Reisner Brenner aided and abetted Steve's alleged violations, again, whether there was no evidence. The administrative law judge had originally found that Mr. Brenner had committed violations of in three accounts. First, the Ryland account, which Mr. Brenner did admit to violating previously in a civil enforcement action filed by the U.S. Attorney's Office here in the Northern District of Illinois. Judge Buckle entered an order in 96R736-1, imposing a 2-year period of probation, sentencing Mr. Brenner to 30 days jail and community service of 300 hours. Other than that, the admitted offense, there's absolutely no evidence to link or establish a violation of Section 8B or Section 13A by either of the respondents. The standard of review to be applied is de novo. The commission, the administrative, the underlying decision was decided on a summary disposition basis. There's no testimonial evidence taken. This is a matter that the court can review de novo, as did the Commodity Futures Trading Commission in one of its opinions. The courts often take these are factual matters which courts confront on a regular basis, and no deference is due to the commission's conclusions, and those conclusions should be reviewed de novo. The second issue for the court's consideration is whether the commission erred as a matter of law by failing to dismiss the Division of Enforcement appeal concerning the sanctions, where the Division of Enforcement abandoned its appeal before the commission, and that the administrative law judge had issued a initial decision and then issued a corrected decision a couple days later. On April 16, 2001, the commission, the division, had filed a notice of appeal and a motion to stay and remand for clarification prior to the commission's acting on it, or before the respondents could oppose the motion. The administrative law judge issued his corrected initial decision. The respondents did appeal from that decision. The commission did not. Subsequently, the division did not file a cross appeal from the plaintiffs or the petitioners' timely appeal, and consequently, the commission was without jurisdiction to entertain the division's appeal with respect to sanctions. And finally, the third issue is whether the commission abused its discretion in imposing significant civil penalties upon the Brenners without benefit of having a hearing as to the financial ability of the petitioners to pay such fine, without considering the petitioner's net worth.
In support of their motion for summary judgment, they did submit what they called the Statement of Undisputed Material Facts and exhibits, including sworn testimony. sworn affidavit, though, so.
Judge, again, investigative deposition testimony, yes. Not subject to cross-examination. Unilateral.
But I understand it wasn't, there was no cross-examination, I understand that, but they did submit some evidence in support of it and claiming that it's undisputed.
Well, Judge, they submitted the deposition transcripts of some deponents, yes, but the deposition testimony that was submitted did not provide any evidence, substantive evidence, of any violation or infraction of the Commodity Exchange Act by Mr. Brenner or by Mrs. Brenner. For example, the administrative law judge had found that Mr. Brenner had, again, committed the infraction with respect to the Boylan account, which he admitted below and which we admitted before the CFTC and admitted here. And also with respect to the trading in the Spike account and the LFG account. The administrative law judge also determined that Mrs. Brenner violated Section 13A by aiding and abetting Mr. Brenner's alleged trades in the Spike account and in the LFG account. On review by the commission affirmed Judge Painter's decision with respect to Mr. Brenner, but vacated the finding as to the Spike account. Again, based on what the record showed, the testimony submitted by the division to the administrative law judge was that with respect to the trading in the Spike account, the deposition testimony of Stephen Wood and Joseph Bruska, neither of whom ever took a trade in that account. Moreover, the division did not depose the order clerk, and more importantly, did it ever seek to subpoena any of the digital tapes of any trade in those accounts. That's the best evidence. They failed to subpoena that. The testimony that Mr. Wood and Mr. Bruska both offered is inconclusive. There's no specific trade ever mentioned as to whether it was on a regulated market or on a foreign currency, which Mr. Brenner is authorized to trade. Again, with respect to the LFG account, the division relied and the commission relied rather extensively on the testimony or the declaration of a Luigi Arima. Mr. Arima opened the account with Mrs. Brenner and had spoken to both Mr. Brenner and Mrs. Brenner about trades in that account. Consequently, the commission's conclusion that because the all of these accounts traded both regulated and non-regulated markets, that all the trades were conducted by Mr. Brenner, they wouldn't stand up to any degree of scrutiny. Again, Mr. Arima testified that he, or declared that he had spoken with Mrs. Brenner about trades in the account. There'd be no reason to talk to Mrs. Brenner about trades in the account if she wasn't trading the account. Similarly, he also declared that he talked to Mr. Brenner about these trades in the account. Mr. Brenner, again, is not barred from trading on foreign indexes. And that's exactly what those records show, is that there was trades in both U.S. markets, Standard & Poor's, and foreign currency indices, the GAX, the FTSE, and the DAX. Again, there was no violation by Mr. Brenner's trading in those foreign currencies. The division has failed to substantiate any link with respect to any violation of Section 8B by Mr. Brenner by pinpointing any specific trade. Again, with respect to the Spike account, there's absolutely no evidence other than conclusory beliefs by Mr. Wood and Mr. Bruska that Mr. Brenner violated the made trades on regulated markets. Again, there's nothing there. There's no tape, digital tape over 4 years that was subpoenaed or produced by the division that would substantiate that claim. I think based on a lack of evidence with respect to the Spike account, the commission's finding with respect to the Spike account is erroneous. It should be reversed. With respect to the LFG account, again, as Mr. Arima testified, both parties traded in that account. Consequently, again, without more, the division failed to carry its burden of production. And there's no factual support for the commission's conclusion. And as the commission held in Inouye Rosenberg, the division must do more than present mere suspicious circumstances raising the possibility of knowing wrongdoing. And the commission's not to act as a rubber stamp, rather its role is to separate what could have happened from what the preponderance of the evidence shows most likely did happen. And again, if both innocent and culpable inferences are reasonably supported by the record, the division fails in its burden of proof. Again, assuming that the evidence is evenly balanced, the tie goes to the runner, so to speak. Here, under the evidence is not closely balanced, the tie should go to the runners. As the Second Circuit Court of Appeals opined, United States versus Gigante, the preponderance standard is no more than a tiebreaker dictating that when the evidence on an issue is evenly balanced, the party with the burden of proof loses. Again, the division had the burden of proof. It failed to sustain that burden by any degree or quantum of proof, and the commission finding in conclusion should be reversed with respect to the trades in the spike account as to Mr. Brunner and the LFG account as to Mr. Brunner, and as to the LFG alleged trade aiding and abetting by Mrs. Brunner, with respect to the second issue that's before the court is to the jurisdiction of the division of the commission's authority to entertain the division's motion or appeal. The court or the commission is without jurisdiction to entertain yet the appeal because, again, the division had abandoned its appeal by failing to timely appeal or cross-appeal from the Brunner's petition, which invoked the jurisdiction of the commission. The issue that the Brunner's appeal did not address any of the sanctions issues. The commission, on review, did not adopt a plenary review position by rule, which it's allowed to do, but rather by, in fact, it did by expanding a de novo review of every issue before the court or before the commission, including the abandoned appeal with respect to the sanctions issue that should not have been addressed by the court for want of jurisdiction. Because the division failed to timely file its notice of appeal, the commission was without jurisdiction, and the division's appeal should have been dismissed. Consequently, the order imposing increased civil penalties should be reversed and the matter dismissed. With respect to the imposition of the financial penalties, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission has the burden of both production and the burden of persuasion on collectability and net worth. The commission failed to undertake any kind of reasoned viewpoint on the question of sanctions, and in so doing abused its discretion. Should this court determine that the division has met its burden of proof and further that the division's appeal should not have been dismissed from one of jurisdiction, the petition for review should nevertheless be allowed and the matter remained up to the commission for it to conduct an evidentiary hearing as the propriety of the monetary sanctions, if any, to be imposed. Again, interestingly, the ALJ declined to impose any civil monetary penalty upon Mrs. Brunner for the alleged violation. The on review of that, the commission imposed a $100,000 civil monetary penalty upon Mrs. Brunner. We think that under the circumstances, again, that was an abuse of discretion. There's no evidence whatsoever on the record that would substantiate any kind of gain that was incurred or that this is the benefit that Mrs. Brunner had obtained from any trades in the LFG account. Consequently, without any evidence to support the finding of the CFTC with respect to the financial sanctions, the court should grant the petition. And if the court determines to remand for further findings, that it include the appropriate direction to the CFTC to entertain the financial sanction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Let me just start with where your opposing counsel ended. What kind of relationship should the penalty, financial penalty, bear to the ability to pay and or the alleged wrongfully gained income?
Well, the the amount of the penalty should bear a rational relationship to the violative conduct. The commission has held in the Nikkahat case, N-I-K-K-H-A-H, which is cited in our brief, that the commission does not mechanically apply the $100,000 penalty per violation for each and every violation. What the commission does is to examine the overall nature of the wrongful conduct to determine an appropriate amount of civil penalties, as well as the other available sanctions that the commission has under the statute. In this particular case, the commission went through a rather detailed analysis to determine the gravity of the petitioner's violations and gravity of the violation.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Let me jump in. The question is the ability of the penalized person to pay part of that?
No, it is not, Your Honor.
That was the question.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question.
No, it was two parts, and that was the main part. But there's no requirement to look for the ability to pay of the violator.
Until 1992, the statute did require that the commission, in addition to measuring the gravity of the violation, determine the amount of penalty, also to determine the collectability of the penalty and the individual net worth of the respondent. Those requirements, except the gravity, were repealed by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission Act, Practices Act of 1992. So the only requirement today is that that the gravity of the violation be determined to determine the amount of the penalty. A hearing itself has never been required. Typically, information relating to net worth and collectability be offered during the administrative proceeding before the administrative law judge.
This proceeding here was not covered by that old statute, the one that's now repealed, or at least those provisions.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's fine. Thank you.
I'd like to turn quickly directly to the evidence that was before the commission, which resulted in the liability findings. First, there's the so-called boiler account, and Mr. Brenner has admitted that he traded futures contracts on U.S. markets in violation of the commission's 10-year trading ban. Based on that admission alone, we believe the court should summarily affirm the commission's liability determination. The account statements that are in the record for the period February and March 1995 for the boiler account show that there were at least 174 trades on United States markets over 33 trading days. Mr. Brenner's admitted violations with respect to the boiler account fully support, just by themselves, the sanctions that were imposed upon Mr. Brenner. The record also shows that the Division of Enforcement did meet its burden under the Commission's summary disposition rules by establishing the factual predicates necessary to support the petitioner's liability with respect to the other two accounts, the Spike and the LFG accounts. With respect to the Spike account, there's no dispute that that account was opened by Mrs. Brenner in her maiden name, Jamie Weisner. The account statements that are in the record show that for the period April to October 1997, there were 192 trades, at least 192 trades, on U.S. markets over 51 trading days. The unrebutted testimony by Spike personnel, Mr. Busta and Mr. Good, established two facts. Number one, that Mr. Brenner was misrepresenting himself as Jamie Weisner, and their testimony provided the link between Mr. Brenner's trading under the name Jamie Weisner and trading through that account on U.S. markets, which he was prohibited from doing. Mr. Brusca stated in his unrebutted testimony that based on telephone calls with Mr. Brenner, who he believed to be Jamie Weisner at the time, handling the orders that the man he knew as Jamie Weisner was phoning in, and a personal meeting with the man he took to be Jamie Weisner, that he knew that there was a man identified as Jamie Weisner who had opened the Spike trading account. And the man that he knew as Jamie Weisner, according to his testimony, traded S&P 500 futures contracts, which are traded on U.S. exchanges and which was prohibited by the Commission's 10-year trading ban. Mr. Brusca also identified a photograph of Mr. Brenner in the Skinner record, in which he identified Mr. Brenner as the man that he knew as Jamie Weisner, who traded the Spike account on U.S. markets. That testimony was corroborated by Spike's Vice President, Stephen Good, who also spoke with the man that he believed to be Jamie Weisner on the telephone. And according to Mr. Good's testimony, Jamie Weisner, the man who knew Jamie Weisner, traded United States markets. We have all of that evidence, but there's more. Requests for admissions were posed to the petitioners, and one that was directed to Mr. Brenner was whether he had traded S&P 500 contracts through the Spike account. In response, Mr. Brenner, as he did throughout his responses to requests for admissions, exercised his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination. The Fifth Amendment jurisprudence that we cite in our brief provides that the mere assertion of the privilege cannot form the basis for a liability finding, but adverse inferences from a party's Fifth Amendment silence in a civil case is permissible when the inferences are combined with other adverse evidence and the inferences are given no more weight than the record warrants. Here we had adverse evidence in the form of the account statements that show trading on U.S. markets, the Brusca and Good testimony. Combining that with an adverse inference arising from the failure to deny that he had not traded on U.S. markets justified the commission concluding that he essentially had admitted he had traded U.S. markets in the request for admissions. So you take all of this evidence together, and the undisputed fact is that Mr. Brenner traded on U.S. markets through the Spike account. Similarly, with the LFG account, there is no dispute that that account was opened in Jamie Weisner's name. An unrebutted sworn statement by a handwriting expert explained that the signature, in fact, on the account opening documents was not Jamie Weisner's. The account statements in the record show that for the period May 1995 through March 1997, there were at least 173 trades on U.S. markets over 43 trading days.
Let me just stop you there, because it's pretty clearly you've outlined in your brief what all this evidence is. I want to ask you a question about the monetary sanctions. How do the monetary sanctions against Brenner compare with the amount of money Brenner actually made on the trades?
Your Honor, I don't know if there is sufficient information in the record to conclude how much money was made on these trades. I don't know.
Okay, I couldn't tell from the brief. I just wondered if you knew that. I mean, that's one factor that they took into account.
That is one factor the commission will typically take into account in determining the amount of a certain penalty, but it's not the only factor.
I understand that, but I couldn't find anything in their order or. I couldn't piece it together myself from the brief how much he actually made on the trade. I just wondered if you knew that.
Well, in that connection, let me just briefly address an argument that's made in the petitioner's reply brief, and the argument's made for the first time. It's the argument that the fines that were imposed were excessive under the Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause. The argument is that the fines bear no relationship to the violations because they supposedly exceed the cumulative value of the violative trades. That cumulative value of the violative trades, just like the amount of any profit that Mr. Brenner may have made, is not clearly reflected in the record. Any of that, as far as the excessive fines argument is concerned, since it's made in a reply brief and it's not developed at all, it would be appropriate under the Seventh Circuit's precedent to disregard the excessive fines.
But the bottom
argument.
Line is we don't know the amount that he actually made.
Well,
and I understand that's just a factor, but we don't have that.
Well, we do know, Your Honor, that there were three counts involved to which he illegally traded. Each of those could count as one violation for purposes of the $100,000 per violation penalty clause. We also know that if you look at the trading accounts statements that are in the record, you can count up 127 trading days that Mr. Brenner traded. So you could multiply that by 100,000 and reach $127 million. That's not what the commission did here.
No, that would be ridiculous, I think.
It would be.
That way, especially when we don't know how much he actually made on them. I understand that.
Exactly. And that's why the commission looked at all the facts and circumstances surrounding the conduct to determine what is a reasonable civil penalty. And particularly since Mr. Brenner had not been dissuaded by the prior statutory trading ban that had imposed upon him, the prior cease and desist order that had been imposed upon him, a federal court permanent injunction, a criminal conviction, all of which arose from illegal trading on U.S. markets, it was appropriate for the commission in this case to sanction him severely. So $300,000 fine plus the permanent trading ban plus another cease and desist order were appropriate under the circumstances. The argument in response to the division's argument, division's evidence rather, as we understand it, is that it should be inferred that Mr. Brenner traded only foreign markets, and Mrs. Brenner did all the U.S. market trading. And as we understand this position, it's based upon two factual predicates. Number one, Mr. Brenner could lawfully trade foreign markets, which we don't dispute, that's acknowledged, he could. Both U.S. and foreign markets were in fact traded through the Spike and the LFG accounts, which also was true. The problem with the petitioner's proposed inference is that it doesn't make any sense on its face. These two factual predicates simply don't support the conclusion. It's defective as a matter of law because it's pure conjecture. One of the Supreme Court's decision in Anderson versus Liberty Lobby, inferences favorable to the petitioners may be drawn from the evidence if they are reasonable. The inference that the petitioners propose is unreasonable on its face. It's simply, in the words of the cases, a metaphysical doubt as to the division's evidence. But the important point is the petitioners have offered as for no evidence of their own to show that Mr. Brenner traded only foreign markets and Mrs. Brenner traded only U.S. markets. It's sheer speculation and is insufficient to prevent the commission from awarding summary disposition in favor of the defendants, rather in favor of the Division of Enforcement.
You're going to mention briefly the jurisdiction, the argument about jurisdiction.
Oh, the
division.
The jurisdiction of the commission to hear the Division of Enforcement's appeal. The division under the commission's rules has all of the powers that the administrative law judge had in making his initial decision. That's in the commission's rules as well as under the Administrative Procedure Act. And sanctions can be reviewed on a de novo basis as recognized by the Seventh Circuit, the Bacillo and the Ryan cases. And under the Commission's Rule 10.104B, on review, the Commission may affirm, reverse, modify, set aside, or remand further proceedings, the Administrative Law Judge's initial decision, and make any findings or conclusions which, in its judgment, deems proper based on the record. So regardless of whether the Division of Enforcement's appeal was properly before the Commission, the Commission was entitled to review sanctions on a de novo basis and change the mix of sanctions to increase the sanctions as it did here if it deemed it appropriate. As a matter of fact, and as a matter of law, the Division's appeal was properly before the Commission because the ALJ had not issued a new decision which started the appeal clock running again. Unlike in the federal system, there's no provision in the commission's rules for the tolling of the filing of the notice of appeal when a post-initial decision motion is filed, as the division enforcement did here. It took its appeal to the commission on the sanctions issue, then asked the commission to remand back to the administrative law judge to consider its clarification motion. That was entirely proper. The administrative law judge issued no initial decision, so the division's appeal was properly before the administrative law, before the commission. I also want to very quickly respond to counsel's argument that the court should use de novo review. Can I just point this up?
Go ahead.
De novo review in reviewing the commission's review on the merits. We have here a commission exercising specialized knowledge and skill in evaluating account statements, evidence collected in the context of commodity trading case, and we believe that the appropriate standard should be deferential. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. How much time? Yeah, 1 minute.
If I may just address one issue with respect to counsel's assertion that there was no evidence showing that trades were made by Mr. Brenner solely on non-regulated markets. Counsel's argument ignores the record in that the affidavit of Stephen Hamholt, H-E-L-M-H-O-L-Z, I believe it's volume I, tab H, shows that he did take trades for both Mrs. Brenner and Mr. Brenner. Jamie traded solely U.S. markets. S&P's and some financials. Mr. Brenner traded only foreign currency indices such as the CAC, the DAX, and the FTSE's. Again, there's also Ronald Boylan's deposition which supports the proposition that Mr. Brenner only traded foreign currency, since Mr. Brenner was an agent for Mr. Brenner with respect to trades on the foreign currency market. Jim Green's deposition, page 15 and 22, also supports the proposition that Mr. Brenner only traded foreign currency, again, pursuant to an agency basis. There's also a Mr. McLean's deposition. Unfortunately, I don't have the record set on those. At pages 7, 24, and 26, which also goes to show that Mr. Brenner only traded foreign currency. The record does not substantiate a... I see my time is out.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.